This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 339 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. It's great to be back. Seems like I've been flying all over the world for the past few weeks, and I feel like I made a guest appearance and then was gone again, and now I'm back.
You've been traveling a lot, haven't you?
I have been busier this first quarter than any other quarter in my entire life.
Well, I'm sure the airlines are happy to be receiving all that business from you.
I bet indeed they are very happy to be taking my money.
I'm sure. Also co-hosting is Benay Wilson, the aviation queen and co-editor-in-chief at airwaste.com. Hi, Benay.
Hello, Max, Brian, our guest, and all of my loyal subjects.
Oh, it's so good to have you back on the show.
Good to be here, Max. Thank you.
Our other co-host, Rob Mark, is, well, he's also traveling, and he may be joining us from an airport somewhere. We'll see if he's able to do that, but we'll soldier on without him. David Vanderhoof is still off. This episode, our guest is Ken Curry. He's president and owner at KC Aviation Consultants in Loveland, Colorado. Now, KC Aviation was established in 2001, and they provide consulting services to aviation businesses and venture capital firms. They also help private jet aircraft owners and buyers with corporate aircraft acquisitions, sales, and charter services. Before that, Ken was president and COO of JetSource, which is a Carlsbad, California fixed base operation. Ken was responsible for over 100 employees there. And then prior to that, he was vice president and general manager of Peterson Aviation. He was there for over 7 years, providing aviation fuel, terminal services, commercial jet charter, and aircraft management services. That was in Van Nuys, California. Before that, Ken was with British Aerospace. You can tell this is another one of our guests that has aviation in their blood. British Aerospace, the last position that he held was vice president of marketing and sales at Arkansas Aerospace in Little Rock, Arkansas. And then Ken also has some military experience. He served in the United States Air Force as a B-52 pilot and aircraft commander. He was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. He flew 157 missions in Southeast Asia, 27 of those missions over North Vietnam. So, Ken, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Max, it's great to be here.
You know, B-52s, it seems like we're going to be flying B-52s forever. It's just the aircraft that just stays there, doesn't it?
Well, it's an amazing airplane, and the version that's still flying was modernized compared to the one that I flew.
Sure. You had the older engines, I assume.
Yes. I had the D model, and they're flying the H, one that's still at it, you know.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about that, but we'll also be talking about KC Aviation and some of the interesting things that that Ken does. Also coming up, we have some aviation news from the past week. United can't seem to stay out of the news. So we have a couple of items about United, also Bombardier with a C-Series milestone. We have an Australia desk, the boys down under. They chat with Flying Officer Guns about the red flag exercise. We don't have exactly an aviation minute. Brian has sent us an aviation minute, and this is this kind of a counter to Rob's recent aviation minute, isn't it, Brian?
An aviation minute rebuttal, if you will.
Ooh, very good. Can't wait. And then we'll finish up with some listener feedback and possibly even a listener recording. I hope we have time to get to that. But let's get started. We've got a full agenda, and we'll begin with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
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 The first story comes from Bloomberg. This is, did United put a whole route in the sky for one very important passenger?
And it wasn't me.
And it wasn't Brian. Well, there's an investigation, it seems. This is to determine if the airline had improper contacts or motives when it provided the then chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey with his very own weekly flight to South Carolina. In fact, he even referred to this as the chairman's flight. The chairman is David Sampson, and the flights for him ended in 2014, April 1st, actually, when he resigned from the Port Authority in a political scandal. And you may remember this one. This is where, I guess, allegedly aides to the New Jersey governor and Port Authority officials set up lane closures on the George Washington Bridge to make a point, and that brought traffic to a standstill for several days. Same guy. So you have to ask, why would United Airlines in effect fly one guy to a very nice destination, or a destination that had a lot of value to him? Binet, any thoughts on that?
This doesn't surprise me at all. I've worked for a couple of airlines, and I remember at one particular airline, I saw what I thought was a kind of odd route and asked about it, and basically was told that I didn't need to worry about it, but it was for a special friend of the airline, and left it at that. So anything, and you know, you're looking at three of the major airports in New York City, so you're going to do whatever you need to do to get some sort of edge, especially at the slot-controlled ones. So, no, this doesn't surprise me at all. Plus, it's got New York and New Jersey mixed into it. Are you kidding?
Yeah. So, what I want to know is, were other people on this flight or these flights as well, or was this an exclusive charter run, if you will?
I think it was kind of an exclusive run. That's what I gathered from the reports, that Sampson was essentially the only passenger on this flight. But yeah, I mean, as you say, Binet, the Port Authority oversees the three major New York airports and really does have a lot of power. United has done some things recently that may or may not be related to all this. There's a 20-year lease extension for United at the airports. At the same time, United has just put up a $35 million maintenance facility at the airport there. That's job creation, you know, that kind of thing. I guess what the investigation is looking to do is determine, you know, was there anything improper in this particular case? Because it's not unusual. You mentioned, Binet, that you've run across a special customer of the airline, and the airlines do have special relationships sometimes with politicians and officials and even business executives. And you know, I guess in some cases that could be okay, but you've got to be careful about others where there could be the implication of some kind of corruption or improper behavior.
Yeah, if the airline's goal is being a public company to maximize profit for the shareholders, running a special plane just for one individual, I'm not sure how that's in my best interest as a stockholder.
Yeah.
If all the other benefits outweigh the cost of that flight. I don't know. I guess I'm contradicting myself here, but
no, but that's a very good point. I mean, you have to think that somebody there looked at the cost benefit of this and thought that it was worth the cost. And I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but just based on this story, somebody must have thought that the cost was worth it to do this flight for this person who wielded a lot of power over the three New York City airports.
And if they did allow other passengers on the flight, then does that make it less severe of an issue, or you know, showing Chicago cronyism over this? Or might be a bad term, but go ahead, edit that out.
I would love to see the load factors on this particular flight.
Well, yeah, there's kind of a gray area. There could be, you know, where's the line? According to you know, the press reports that airlines have relationships. In fact, Congress members often get top tier status from the airlines. Is that improper? Well, that feels more benign than scheduling a weekly flight for, you know, for one official.
Having those special flight those special privileges for your congressional delegation, that's just life-saving. I remember some of those, too. And it just made life a lot easier.
Well, we'll see where the investigation goes. There's a federal investigation, I understand, and also United themselves are conducting an investigation to kind of get to the bottom of this. And so it'll be interesting to follow that along. We'll see where those go.
Oh, but isn't that like Putin saying that he's going to investigate the death of his competitor? You're right. We're not supposed to be political. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
More edits.
We'll just leave it there. United has been in the news recently in another area as well. We have a piece from, this is actually from a Good Morning America report on Yahoo News. United Airlines officials highlight, quote, near misses in safety message to pilots. And in January, United pilots received this safety bulletin. There were a number of incidents, four incidents where flight crew errors were called, quote, major safety events and near misses. And the bulletin came from two guys, United's senior vice president of flight operations and also the vice president of corporate safety. In the safety alert, they say the common thread with all these is that they are preventable. Just examples, the four incidents, they said that there were two near the ground, one requiring a pull-up maneuver. There was also an, quote, an undesired aircraft state on departure. I'm not sure what that means exactly. And then a low fuel state on arrival. But back to the safety alert that United sent to the pilots, it says, we must ask ourselves, do we have our priorities in line every time we put on our uniforms and strap into the airplane? While the airline industry always seems to be in a state of flux, the one constant for all of us is that we are professional aviators with the common goal of flying our passengers and crew from point A to point B safely. Well, I guess some of the pilots kind of thought this was well, a little bit strong. Ken, do you think it's unreasonable for an airline, the executives, to, you know, issue this kind of a notification to their pilots?
Yeah, I think it's unreasonable. I think it's kind of unprofessional as well.
Do you think that the pilots are warranted in sort of taking this personally?
Yeah. Yeah, I probably are.
Yeah, so Ken, is that with the assumption that the airlines making a statement that the pilots aren't acting professionally or safety conscious the entire time, so the airline right. has to remind them to be, you know, more in tune with safety?
Well, hopefully that's not the reality. There's some truth to that, yeah.
Another point that that's made in this this letter to the pilots is it notes that there's another common thread to some of these events. It's a lack of attention to disciplined crew resource management, CRM.
Right.
It says, every time we enter the cockpit with the intention of performing our pilot duties, we evaluate risk. Every pilot must be willing to speak up if safety is in question. In the same vein, every pilot must also accept the input of their fellow crew members on the flight deck. In most cases, one of the pilots recognizes an unsafe situation. In some cases, a pilot's input is ignored. This is unacceptable. But that is sort of basic CRM, right? That that should be part of the normal behavior that comes about through CRM training and awareness, I would think.
Absolutely. I think that's true. It should be.
But that one does feel kind of directed, you know, strongly at the performance or the lack of professionalism of the pilots, I guess. Well, interestingly, Rob Mark saw this, and when this item came into the news, was reported in the news, Rob started receiving some documents from pilots, and we'll put a link to Rob's Jetwine post in the show notes, but he titles it at United Airlines, Does Making Money Trump Safety? And some of the pilots were, well, making the point that United's training and sort of safety perspective isn't really what it should be. And it's kind of the flip story of this this item where United is sending the pilots this letter. This feels like it's a kind of a difficult situation brewing here, where the company is, well, making statements that the pilots take to mean that you know they're not flying safely, and then the pilots, or at least some of them at the same time, are coming back and saying that United is not doing their part in this equation as well. So that sounds like some pretty strong discord brewing.
Yeah, Max, I just wonder, with one of the issues, they talked about plane landing with low fuel. Hmm. Before making that statement, you kind of have to look at, why did it happen? Did they experience strong headwind? Was there a diversion somewhere along the way? Did the planners not put enough fuel on? Did the pilots ask for the fuel, but yet the dispatchers say no to it?
Yeah.
I would like to imagine that that would never happen. But if it did, it's not so much the pilot's fault at that point. It's the airline's fault. And maybe there is some truth to the airline being preemptive, trying to
address this.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Really, we cannot evaluate at all any of these incidents, these so-called four incidents or any others that occurred without understanding the facts and it being investigated. Because, yeah, like you say, Brian, there could be lots of reasons why this happened. And, you know, they may point to one group, another group, or many groups. You really can't say. We really can't say at this point. Don't have that information.
And to me, it seems the timing is kind of interesting, too.
Hmm.
I can't imagine that pilots are going out there and just being unsafe. I mean, it's just not part of the culture.
Right.
It's not what you do. But then you wonder if, you know, and I'm not saying this, I'm just asking as devil's advocate, you wonder if there could be some people who are a little upset about some of United's cost-cutting measures in other areas, you know, because they came up with that plan to cut $1 billion in costs. You know, that can cause some hard feelings among people if they feel like that money is coming out of their area.
Yeah, it could be deficiencies in the relationship between the pilots and the company that really is the sort of the root at what's going on here. It's hard to say, but it certainly seems plausible.
Yeah, and I just wonder if this went out to the legacy United pilots or the legacy Continental pilots or to both. And, you know, how much the fact that they're still not together, you know, how much that's causing of an issue here as well.
Right, right. Yeah, good point. All right, well, let's move on and talk about Bombardier. Now, they reached a milestone. The Bombardier CS-300 made a five-hour maiden test flight. They flew from Mirabel Airport outside of Montreal, and this occurred February 27th. In its press release, Bombardier says the aircraft and its systems performed as expected, which is kind of usually what you hear from these sorts of things. But a five-hour test flight, that sounds pretty good. I mean, if you are encountering the problems, which really would not be unexpected on the first test flight for a new aircraft. You would probably look for something shorter than 5 hours, but they reach an altitude of 41,000 feet, a speed of 255 knots, according to the press release. So this is the second C-Series. Of course, there's the CS-100 and now the larger CS-300. And so this is good news, I think, that Bombardier has reached this milestone.
Yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to flying it. I think that it's good that there's competition for Airbus and Boeing. They seem to be phenomenally late to market with this product, but it, if they could get it off the assembly line, I think it'll be great for everyone.
Yeah, now the C-Series, yeah, right, it has not garnered the volume of orders that they had hoped. Bombardier said that they were looking to get 300 firm orders on the books by entry into service. They've got 243 now. And most of those are actually CS-300s. The orders are about 2-to-1, the CS-300 to CS-100. And they're looking at entry into service for the 100, the CS-100, in the second half of this year, 2015. Probably deep into the second half, I would guess. But that's a great achievement at this point. Hopefully, they won't encounter major problems. They have a number of test aircraft flying now, and I understand they have about 1,000 hours on the CS-100. Test airplanes.
Max, has Mary Kirby said anything about the interiors of that? Or Binet, have you seen any plans? And I'm just really interested to see what the interior looks like and how much space there's actually going to be.
We got some pictures, but I didn't get a chance to look at them today. I'm not going to lie. It's been a little busy. But I haven't seen anything from Mary on the interiors yet.
Well, we'll have to follow up with that. That's a great question.
But I think the bigger issue, and Max, you kind of touched on it, the long delays on this program. And I mean, it's been a little chaotic. I mean, they had this major shakeup at the top, only for the second time in the company's history, they have a non-family member, running things. Pierre Beaudoin kind of kicked himself upstairs to executive chairman, and his father retired.
Yeah, they brought in a new chief executive, Alan Bellmeyer, who's formerly with United Technologies. He headed the Aerospace and Propulsion Systems Division, which included Pratt & Whitney. He is Canadian, and he knows Bombardier really well because of the geared turbofan engine, the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine that's used on the C-Series aircraft. So he knows the product very well. And I guess the press reports have been pretty positive about his move to Bombardier. And of course, I think it pretty much everyone recognizes that Bombardier does need a little bit of shakeup, at least on the financial side.
Yeah, and they talked about that in their investor call last month. It was very enlightening. It's one of the longer investment calls that I've ever been on because, I mean, they stayed on there. I have to give them credit. They were answering as many questions as they were able to answer. But I think the bigger question is, what is the long-term prospects, the long-term market for this family of aircraft? And Airways News, we did a report. It actually came from Air Insights, which is something Addison Shulman does.
Yes.
And there was an interesting piece in there about how Bombardier decided to go head-to-head with Airbus and Boeing in this particular market segment. But unlike Airbus and Boeing, Bombardier doesn't have the backlog and the financial resources to do some of the deals that Boeing and Airbus are able to do in that same market segment.
Yes, when you're a Boeing with the 737 and Airbus with the A320 series, you've got a cash flow that's very, very helpful when it comes to developing a new product or making changes like that. Bombardier, while you know, not an insignificant company, doesn't have anywhere near that those kind of resources. So it has been a challenge for them. And like you say, Binay, they're getting into a new class of aircraft, you know, on top of all the other things. So I guess the only thing that would have been surprising to me is if the thing had been, you know, on time, on budget, and that would have been kind of amazing.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, that would have been, but this is par for the course for airliner programs. I mean, Boeing went through it with the 787, Airbus went through it with the A380 and the A350. I mean, so, and you know, this is just, I would have been really surprised if everything had been on time and perfect. It just doesn't happen.
Again, we're speaking with Ken Curry. He's the president and owner of KC Aviation Consultants. Ken, tell our listeners just what does KC Aviation Consultants do?
Well, it's basically a result of my broad background in aviation. I've done all kinds, everything from human resource issues and in flight operations to how to staff a flight department to issues like how to market GEO, how to make it more visible, just a variety of various assignments. Airplane selection, I've done quite a bit with that, both to operators and to organizations that want to expand their charter, for example, what should they have, you know, that type of thing.
Tell us about some of your typical clients.
Well, they're all established operators in my case. They're a small flight operation, or they're an FBO with a flight operation and a maintenance side as well. Worked on that arena. And then there's all issues to do with airports. I'm not an expert on airports, but another area you certainly get exposed to when you're working with FBOs. They have to comply with the airport requirements. And as those issues come, various companies, they want to reach out and get the latest information and get feedback from someone outside that can be objective.
And what are the kind of objectives these days, you know, given this economy? Are people looking to expand their business, or are people looking to cut their costs, or is it just all over the board?
I think it's both, and I think it's really all over the board. And the aviation side of things, in the airlines, as it is with corporate operators and charter operators, as long as the airplanes are in the air and they have people on them, they're making money. But if they're not in the air, then they're in trouble. So it's an ongoing challenge. You've got to maintain your equipment, and the standards are these days. And so there's a variety of challenges that people have in any of those areas, and that's most of the work I've done. And then, of course, I've worked with wealthy people too, to some degree, that want to sell what they've got and buy something else. And that's another whole different arena. But it's all aviation, and it's all kind of interwoven. It's amazing to me how the commercial side, the airlines, in many ways are very similar to the private side, in that, like I said, you've got to have the airplanes up in the air, and you've got to have them flying or making money.
Ken, tell us about FBOs. There are, you know, as a business segment, in terms of just numbers, I mean, maybe it's one of the biggest segments. There are FBOs everywhere, all over the place.
Right.
At least in the United States, because yes. You know, we have so many airports you know, throughout the country.
Absolutely.
How are FBOs doing these days?
Well, I think they're struggling to some degree. Have over the past, probably ever since probably 2007, 2008, you know, when the economy turned down. And well, there's two elements to the FBO operations that are critical. That's people buying fuel and people renting space from them, in many cases in their hangars. And if they're not buying fuel and they're renting space, well, the cash flow is definitely affected. And so it's a tough business. And and it's all service-oriented. That's another area that I've spent a lot of time on with some of my clients. You know, how do you improve your service, and how do you make yourself visible in the community. And, you know, I think I have some good value in many cases for some of the companies I've worked with.
So are they having to diversify as well?
Well, they can only diversify so much, you know, because they'll have so many tenants in their hangars, and then they'll have so many people coming in for fuel and the transient thing. And then, of course, if you've got a charter operation, that helps you quite a bit. But the littler FBOs, they have a tough challenge. They've got to be selling the fuel. That's making money, you know, really is. That and then the leaseholds, you know, the people that are renting right. The hangar space.
Do people create new FBOs? I mean, are the numbers of them expanding, or is it difficult to enter into that? I mean, if you're thinking that you'd like to get into that business, let's just say, Is it relatively easy to create a new FBO, or would you have to start to look for, you know, one that's for sale, an existing FBO?
I think that's exactly right, Max. That's where most go to an existing operation, because, you know, you've got all the regulatory too. That's the other huge piece in aviation that in the industry you tend to forget about even sometimes, you know. I mean, that may sound strange, but there's you know, all the regulatory issues that have to do with even the fueling part of the whole operation, and then, you know, the safety and so many things. So not an easy field to enter. There's certainly some that have grown, some of the FBO chains that have grown in the last 10 years, quite remarkably. But they've been aggressive, and they've targeted operations that have relatively good cash flow. And then they've done a good job marketing.
So then we're seeing some consolidation of a sort?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And sometimes the ownership is not visible. I'm thinking of one company in particular. And I won't mention the location or anything, but you would never know from the name of the company that they own probably 12 or 14 FBOs, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, Ken, I always assumed that FBOs were privately held. So you're saying that there's a fair amount of corporate ownership. And so these aren't family-run businesses that are handed down through the generations. It's a possibly franchise-like business the way other industries are run.
Yeah, I don't really think it models franchising as much as I do, you know. Yeah, a lot of them were family owned and still are, but you know, the one I'm thinking of, one in particular, is a family organization, but it's the mom and pop FBO, like the gas station on the corner. You know, it's a big business, and it's the guys that run it look at it that way. So, you know, the name of their holding corporation never visible to the public. So what you see is what's there for the public to see, and it's interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I never really had that kind of insight into what that segment of the business is like and how it fits into the overall aviation scenario. At an airport, an FBO is typically a separate business entity from the airport operation itself, correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And usually they occupy a certain amount of space. And, well, for example, in the case of Van Nuys, really, there's multiple FBOs and all competing and all trying to get a piece of the business. So it can be very, very competitive, too.
Interesting.
It was interesting because I was doing an interview today with the general manager of Houston Hobby Airport.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that he mentioned is that Hobby has 5 FBOs and a 6th one getting ready to open.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, what? And, you know, it turns out it has a close proximity to downtown. And
sure. You know, it's a great airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. The key element there determines who the winners are in that kind of a situation is really the marketing and the service. You know, it's a service industry just like the airlines. So you and I know as consumers, if we get good service, even at the grocery store, you know, it leaves a good impression on us. And so that's what's really driving the ones that are really successful. They really focus on a high level of service at airports, you know. So, and it goes from everything to the pilots a free car to take or, you know, all kinds of things. So, but service is what it's all about.
So I'm curious, Ken, as a consultant, I think a lot of folks who have spent careers in aviation have a lot of experience and knowledge. think towards becoming a consultant, maybe in sort of the later portions of their working career,
right?
Because for a lot of really good reasons. But why did you take this path?
Well, I think you kind of defined it right there, because I chose it because I realized I'd had such a tremendous broad experience in the Asian industry. You know, everything from some of the companies I worked for did completions, aircraft completions, modifications, and then maintenance. I had this big maintenance operation, a certified repair station. Then, you know, the FBO experience, just multiple things. And being a pilot myself and having flown in the military, and, you know, I just felt like that my experience could be of value to others. And I would and still do like to share my experience and be a help to them. So really, I come alongside them. I don't come along trying to change everything, but I come along with my eyes wide open and my experience, and I'm able to point things out to them that make them become more of a success in what they're doing. So, you know, and it's a challenge for a lot of people to make it happen. So I think I fill a little niche that's needed.
Yeah, Ken, I think a lot of people, when they think about the aviation industry, think of becoming a pilot first. And mm-hmm. there are all these other elements of aviation. Any advice for any of our listeners, things to look into for some of these other non-pilot areas?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've talked to, I've mentored a couple of young men, that one of whom I'm very proud to know, and he's getting his law degree, and he's going to specialize in aviation law. And I think it's terrific. So, yeah, you're right. There's just a diverse number of roles other than pilot. Even the maintenance side of things, if you're interested in maintenance, you know, that's another arena. And then the line service operation is where the service is really delivered, you know, and a young man can start out there and he can work his way into all kinds of other arenas as he gets older, gets more experienced. And one of the guys that I used to have, he oversees six private airports in Southern California now. He used to be my line service manager. So there's an example. Another guy is a commander in the Navy, a Navy pilot, but he was a line service guy. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting stories about young men and women, I think now too, who have flown and then segued out into other areas that still had a connection to aviation.
So how do you end up getting one of those jobs? Do you just show up at the FBO and ask for the owner and say, hey, I'm here, give me a job, I want to do something?
Literally, you've got it pegged, Brian. That's exactly what it takes. And I don't think it's changed today, really. You have that desire, you know, that desire to be around airplanes and that love of that whole, you know, aviation, the whole drama of it all and the, you know, the excitement, and you go for it. And that's what I've seen. I've seen that played out many times as an observer and as an operating an FBO and all that type of thing, too.
Well, Ken, let's go all the way back to the beginning. Was there some defining moment, some influence that sparked your interest in aviation, or is it just something that you just sort of fell into?
No, it wasn't. Well, I did sort of fall into it, sort of. But you see, I grew up just north of the LA airport in Los Angeles, and in a town, actually, it's always had this name, Westchester, and it's not a separate city. It's part of the city of Los Angeles, but that's where I grew up. So I was enthralled with the airport. I couldn't see it from where I lived, but just north of me was the Hughes Aircraft Company. And in those days, that was an active airport, but just for Hughes Aircraft. And so I grew up between those two airports. Yeah, aviation was just all around me. And so I started getting involved with flying model airplanes, and had a friend down the street, and we built gliders, and we even had a huge Army kite we flew one. Wow. One day, and, you know, just a variety of experiences. And of course, you didn't have to go far to see them landing and taking off either, you know. So that's how it started for me.
You know, I remember Well, actually, I don't remember. I don't remember the first time I saw a B-52 flying. Oh. But I remember very clearly the effect that it had on me. And it felt like it was just mean, like a big, mean, scary airplane.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that negatively. I mean that in kind of a positive vein. It really kind of communicated the power and force and
intimidating.
Intimidating. That's the word.
Yeah.
Now you were maybe you were the guy up there flying that one that I saw. But how does it look from the cockpit?
Oh, it's a great airplane. I mean, it's a Boeing airplane. You know, I can say nothing but great things about Boeing airplanes because it is one. But it's how did it feel? Well, 450,000 pounds gross weight, max gross weight, and you know, we had water injection on the model I flew because it was an older airplane. And but once you got it going, it was something else. Our mission was a really mixed mission, so you know, I had to learn air-to-air refueling. I had to learn how to fly a low-level route, 100 feet off, 250 feet off the deck, something like that. And
wow,
just a wide variety. Yeah, we had a low-level mission, you know, in the Cold War, so had to fly it in all kinds of different conditions. And of course, during the Vietnam War, you know, it was the war, so you know, the refueling oftentimes took place in a total IFR conditions and very challenging. The only pilot that was allowed to refuel was the aircraft commander. The co-pilot just sat there and watched. He wasn't certified to fly the refueling part. So,
why was that? Is that because it was such a difficult task and required really specialized training? I'm guessing.
Yeah, to some degree. I wouldn't say specialized, but yeah, definitely specialized and learn how to do it. But they didn't want to risk someone with less experience to be up there trying to refuel because it did take a lot of practice and a lot of concentration. So, you know, we'd hang on the boom for 30 minutes, you know, during the war, and that's a long time, you know, to be really close to another airplane. I mean, you're talking not very far away from that tanker, and he's plugged into you. So, yeah, it was exciting. It really was exciting.
So, recently, there was the accident in Taiwan with a plane that had a single engine. Well, it's twin engine aircraft. The first engine went out.
Yeah, I saw that.
Flying the B-52 with eight engines. Did you ever experience any? How reliable were those engines? And if one engine went out, was it a big deal or not?
No.
I've always wondered about that.
No, one engine out. No problem. Two engines out. Yeah, definitely noticeable. But you could still keep it in the air with two engines out. Any more than that, you'd be in trouble. But one engine out wasn't really big. During the war, I mean, we had to refuel if we had lost an engine, and I did that several times. So, you know, refueling with six engines or seven engines rather than eight was definitely challenging. But we could do it.
Do I understand you had a mission where you actually got pretty shot up in the course of that mission?
Yeah.
A lot of holes in the airplane?
Yes.
What's that story?
Well, I'll try to make it short and sweet. 1972, I was number two in a flight of two. I was Aqua 2, and we had a mission against an airfield, a North Vietnamese airfield, and our target really was the surface air missile sites. And a high-risk mission with – we had jamming equipment, electronic countermeasures, and we basically just got hit by a barrage of SA-2 guideline missiles, which were the common missile at that point in time, the Soviet missile. And we just released our weapons, and it was a wild ride. We started our evasive maneuvers, which basically were separately, even though we were in a formation, we were to do the evasive maneuvers separately. And so it would be left and right, 30 degrees off the heading that we were on, climbing and descending 1,000 feet above and below the altitude we were starting from. And, of course, using 45 degrees of bank in the turn. So this was a radical maneuver for that big airplane. But it was the way that we were able to, in my case, almost avoid being hit directly. We were doing these evasive maneuvers, and we knew the missile was locked onto us, but we knew we could be affected by doing the maneuvers. So I was in the second turn back to the right, about 30 degrees of bank, and the missile, and I realized it wasn't going to be able to hit me. So it basically did what they call the apogee. You know, it turned over the top of its, over in an arc toward me, and sprayed the airplane with shrapnel from the conical spray of the high explosive going off in the missile. Now, the missile was fused with proximity fuse, which basically was a metal sensing device, and it sprayed the airplane. And when I got back to my home base in Thailand that night, I was called in, and the gentleman, the deputy commander of operations that was asking me about the flight, told me that we had over 40 major holes in the airplane. And I said, well, what's a major hole? I don't know what that is. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, that's a hole 4 inches in a diameter or larger.
Wow. Oh, gee.
Now, it was an absolute miracle that I'm here today. And the interesting part is you can go to the website for the National Museum of the United States Air Force, and it's in Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
And my airplane that I was flying on April 9th, 1972 is in the museum.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, I've been to that museum. Yeah, it's a fantastic museum.
Yeah, and it's a great website, by the way, too. So you can go on the website and you can look up Vietnam era B-52D, and you've got to click around a little bit, but there's a whole explanation of the damage and the repair and the whole thing. And so yeah, I've been there to see it myself, and that airplane's always, as long as I'm around, it's always going to have a special place in my heart because it saved my bacon, you know.
Absolutely.
And my crew. And my crew.
Sure.
That is just, I'm stunned. I mean, my mouth is opening. I'm actually the daughter and granddaughter of Air Force officers. And
my dad's
last assignment before he retired was at Wright-Patt. And our next door neighbor was the curator of the Air Force Museum.
Fantastic.
So I got to go in and take the behind the scenes tour. And I highly recommend going to that museum anyway. But
I do too. I wanted
to ask you, in your career, of all the places you were stationed, what were some of your favorite places to be stationed?
I had a pretty cushy deal. You know, I went through pilot training in Mesa, Arizona, and I ended up getting B-52 after pilot training. And I did have a choice. They usually give a block of airplanes to you. They got down to me, and I was in the lower quarter of the class, actually, and the only thing that was left was B-52 and the tanker. Decided I didn't want to be a flying gas station. So anyway, back to what you asked. So then I ended up at March Air Force Base in Southern California there for my whole career. The time I was in the U.S., you know, I was overseas three times, actually, during the Vietnam War, and that's how I crewed all those missions. I flew 42 missions as a co-pilot in 1970. In 71, I was upgraded back and flew the other 115 over there with my own crew, and was over there twice. We didn't go over for a year's tour. We went over on temporary duty, so we weren't permanently assigned to.
Well, Ken, let's bring this back to the present now, and maybe the linkage is you could tell us a little bit about how this military experience of yours really prepared you for life in the civilian world, or gave you a leg up or some perspectives that kind of helped you in your career?
Yeah, I think it had a tremendous impact on me. Got my MBA using the GI Bill, but I was already working in the aviation business at that point. My military experience really added the tremendous professionalism that was expected in the Strategic Air Command of those days. You know, that really was my guiding light. I wanted to do everything right, and I wanted everybody to do the same thing and feel good about being the best. you know, it was something that was really drilled into me, I think. And Curtis LeMay was the guy that started the Strategic Air Command or headed it up, and he was exactly on time. I mean, and this was true even in Southeast Asia. You did not cross the hold line at the end of the runway until the time was exactly on the second. You know, that drizzles down to the everything you do. You know, you just do things correctly, and they're done right, and things are safe, and you're careful, and you follow the rules. You know.
Yeah, I think that kind of grounding, that kind of baselining at an early stage in your career or your life, it carries throughout your entire life. You learn those basics, yeah, and they're with you always. Well, Ken, maybe if our listeners are interested in learning more about KC Aviation Consultants or want to get in touch with you in some way, what's the best way for them to do that?
If they want to contact me, my phone is 818-632-9808.
Max, I did actually want to ask Ken one last question.
Okay.
And it seems like all the military pilots, it's a question that I always ask them, that if they're still flying today, what are you flying?
I'm not flying anymore. My last flight was up in a Citabria here in Colorado. With the young man I mentioned to you that's gone back to law school, and he had a flight training school, and we did some aerobatics, and it was great fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my aerobatics experience is limited to some years ago now, an aerobatic glider. So it was actually the first, well, and only time I'd been in a glider, and it was an aerobatic, about a 45-minute aerobatic run, which was... Well, I amazed them because some of the pre-flight instruction was what to do when you throw up inside the glider.
Yeah, right.
And I didn't, which really surprised everyone, including myself.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 2nd of March, 2015, and we survived Avalon again.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 339. And Grant, the question is, did Avalon survive us?
Yeah, I think it did.
I think it did, yes. I think they've Stephen Grant-proofed that place now after our third tour of there. What do you think?
They do seem to. They've done a pretty good job of it.
Well, Avalon, the Australian International Air Show. We only have one every second year, so the team went down there again, and we had a pretty big week there. Probably not as big as we normally have because we were a little bit constrained with resources this year, but notwithstanding that, we still had a fantastic time. I guess with the air show, it's a lot of more of the same, really. I mean, Avalon, much like Farnborough and a lot of the other big international air shows, it's essentially a trade show about heavy metal. Not a lot of GA there, unfortunately, which I always think it's unfortunately. Grant, what do you reckon?
Look, I don't think it's going to work just purely for GA. It would take a lot of changes at the high levels of that show to make them more GA friendly. They really are set on being a little Australian Farnborough or Singapore Air Show or things like that. They are trade shows. They're primarily all about the trade, and everything else is tacked on. Until you have camping alongside your aircraft at the airport, it's not going to be an Oshkosh by any stretch of the imagination.
I'm totally up for camping under the wing of an aircraft, Grant, particularly if it was the A400 M, which made its debut at the air show, and I believe its debut in Australia, a very, very, very impressive looking machine, almost as nice as the Herc, maybe even nicer. Big call there.
Oh, mate, it's getting under your skin. That's pretty impressive.
It certainly had better restrooms in it.
That much is certain. Airliner toilets. Yay!
Well, you can hear all of our coverage of the Australian International Air Show for 2015 over at our website, planecrazydownunder.com, and the latest episode, number 123, is an hour and a half of interviews there of some of the personalities. We had a really good time, and I reckon, Grant, we've got enough content to make probably two more podcasts out of it. But speaking of Royal Australian Air Force personnel, we had a talk to Flying Officer Guns, and we'll leave it that way for OPSEC reasons. And he was telling us about some wonderful experiences he's had recently with the C-130s over there at Red Flag near Las Vegas.
Yep, and we started off by talking about the weather.
Yeah, it was. It was actually surprisingly hot for early time of year over there, and quite intense, which kind of made it even hotter for us. outside of the weather.
Even in the aircon, it was running pretty hot.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So you've got a command rating on the C-130J?
Yes.
Straight out of flight school into the Js?
Yes.
Okay, so the usual thing, CT4, PC9, and yep. then over to the, what do you fly next, the King Air?
No, you go from the CT4 to the PC9, and I went straight to the Js.
Wow.
So yeah,
suddenly there's a whole lot more throttles.
There's a lot more asymmetrics, yeah, that's for sure.
And a nicer toilet.
Yeah. Well, that's debatable.
No, it's okay. Yeah, there is always that.
Yeah.
So, okay, how long have you been flying on command on the...
I've only had command for about 4 months now, but I've been on the J for over 2 years.
How many hours, roughly?
1,300.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So how'd you get selected to go to Red Flag?
I'd previously been working in the electronic warfare area and special operations within the C-130J capability. And then I got my command and a spot opened up for to go over as a tactician, so planning and organising the missions. And I put my hand up to go and do that, to be part of the exercise, to get that experience.
Cool. So, yeah, you were in tactical, so you were putting everything together.
Yeah.
You were one of the boffins in the back room who made sure that the mission worked, yeah?
Yeah, I had the fun job with no sun. So we're in the back room. You'd have a planning day the day before each vol cycle or flown cycle. That'd last 12 to 14 hours where you'd be integrating with all the players that'd be operating the next day and coming up with a plan as to how we're going to fly it into, you know, what sort of environment that we are, whether it's a all-up war or there's a whole bunch of different things we operate in that.
So speaking of flying, everybody who would be vaguely familiar with Red Flag would instantly think fighter jets. So obviously, you know, flying a C-130 is obviously a completely different role. Can you describe from an airlifter point of view what Red Flag means?
Well, Red Flag for us is learning how to integrate within a large force element and an exercise where we work with fighters, AWACS, tankers, ISR assets, troops on the ground. It's really for us to get involved in that sphere and be a part of it and be able to operate with them in their environment, which is a great benefit for us when we're trying to push forward with the capability of the C-130J, where we're doing more work with the special men and women of the Australian and American Defence Forces. So in doing that, it's actually a huge benefit for us to be over there working with them and integrating with their systems. And I think it helps them a lot as well, seeing how we work. It's been good.
That's an interesting aspect. Do you find much difference between the way, say, the USAP operates in that environment to the way the RAF operates?
Well, to be honest, I haven't done a lot of large force element group exercises with the RAF. Anytime you do that, we tend to end up using the USAF or the Marines or whoever. They kind of run the show there. So I couldn't really give you a good answer on whether or not it's different, because most of the work that we do with the RAF, say the MER, I think it's called now, is done in a small group anyway, because we're, you know, moving things from A to B, as opposed to participating in an all-up war, which is what you do when you go to a Red Flag.
Now, you mentioned about the planning. So you spend a day beforehand. The day before, you spend a lot of time putting that plan together. How do the plans come down? Is it like, yo, guys, take this, you know, get this from here to here? Or what's the kind of parameters that you get, and then how do you work it through to actually rubber on the tarmac in a way?
Okay, well, generally there's a mission outcome that's been pre-decided that the guy's going to want to try and achieve, and they'll give a sort of a group of people there to be a commander, and they'll run what they plan as the mission for the next day. Like anyone going out, if you want to do a NAVEX or something around Australia, you're planning it, except they're planning it for 70 aircraft, and they're working out from their perspective how they're going to integrate you within the outcomes at which they've been directed to achieve by their high command. So the whole planning process is them deciding where they're going to use which asset, at which point, where airlift's going to come in, where the seed's going to work, where strike's going to get involved, and they bring that all together and try and pull in a solid plan and get approval for that for the night before, so they can brief for the next day and then step and launch for the vol the next day.
So there's a lot of integrating with multiple force assets from multiple forces. How have you found that integration working? Is everyone talking the same language?
We are. And because we're getting more and more involved in these American exercises, like Cope North, like the Flag Alaska and Flag Nellis, we do really talk the same sort of language. So the integration really is starting to develop quite strongly. I think it works reasonably seamlessly. And you get to learn the different, what the different pilots in different frames, how their personalities go and what they actually are looking to and trying to achieve every day, because it can be quite different.
When you're talking about planning, obviously there's a plan, but obviously particularly in that sort of environment, I guess nothing goes to plan. So how much contingency is built into your planning?
Well, yes, there is plan A, B, and then every every other plan that you can conceivably think of. It is, as you correctly suggested there, it's a very dynamic environment once you launch for the day. So it becomes quite interesting. There's obviously, they have AWACS, like we have here on demonstration, operating up there at the time. So they're still running the air war. So when things are going left, right of centre, they've got guys up there that are running the show. And the mission commander from the day before is also still heavily involved in, all right, okay, this isn't working, let's try this, or this isn't working, let's try this. And then you've got all the other things with all the comms and all that stuff which is going on, which is really quite interesting. Yeah.
I believe it was von Clausewitz who said, no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Yeah, that's true, even if the enemy isn't shooting back.
Yeah, even if it's just dots on the screen.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, now you just threw reference there to Flag Alaska.
Yeah.
Elmendorf, the rather different, completely different environment to Nellis. Nellis being hot and desert, Elmendorf being typically cold and frigid. How was it when you worked out at Elmendorf?
Elmendorf was a really great experience, actually. The thing that we don't get in Australia that the Americans do have, and it's the same, I guess, in Nellis, but is the terrain up there. And the terrain up in Alaska is quite high, very remote, and it is one of the biggest sort of air exercises in the world in terms of space. So Nellis is quite constricted, whereas Elmendorf has got a heap of space. And we have more airlift players up there. So we still had the same integration with the fighters, and we still had pretty much the same number of aircraft, but we had more airlift assets. So it actually became interesting that trying to work with other nations, because we had the Japanese and the USAF there as well, and operate with them. And we got to operate as HAVR assets a few times there, which was really, really good, where we would be, the whole mission would be based around us. And it was quite interesting. As I was saying before, we got to drop 240 paratroopers in formation on a drop zone there, which was pretty impressive. I wish I was on the ground, actually, to watch it.
Yeah. It would have been parachutes and guys going everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so now we spoke to X before, and he was telling us about the lessons learned from the Loadmaster perspective, and a big one for him was just the chatter on the radio. Pilots grow up with that. Loadmasters are something new. What were the lessons you brought back from both Alaska and Nellis?
Well, the major lessons that we bring back are planning and integration. Our TTPs for how we operate, I think, are becoming rather good for our low-level and our nighttime work and our formation work. We've still got a lot of areas to develop, but the major things we're getting out of Flag is the integration and the large force exercises that we do over there. So being able to integrate with the USAF, with the Marines, with the Army, with the JASDAF, all those types, and do it as a big group and be able to operate, as the Loadmasters were saying, with all those radios going at the same time. So we've got six radios running at the same time that we've got to monitor, and only two guys up the front. So that's where the Loadmasters now become quite a valuable asset, in that they can listen to the radios too and give us feedback, because no matter how good we think we are, we can't listen to six radios at once and be effective. So, yeah, the major thing I get out of that is us integrating and really becoming a part of those bigger groups, and in doing that, getting more awareness from the command perspective of both the Australian and the US military of how the Hercules can actually operate, particularly the J, how effectively we can operate. And it's a very effective aircraft when used in the ways that it's designed for.
Well, there you go, Grant. And I guess, as the saying goes, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Unless it hitches a ride on your person. But we won't go there.
No, we won't go there indeed. Well, I guess, Grant, after all that air showing and stuff, after a week at Avalon, I think we need a rest. I think we should sign off until next week.
I think you're right, mate. I'm Grant McCarran.
And I'm Steve Vischer. Cheers, folks.
There you go. That'll confuse him. We did it round the other way.
Oh, I'm confused myself.
I know.
Who am I?
It must be Monday.
Well, Ken, you know, we have a quite a large number of listeners from down under. Did you ever run across any Australian pilots over the years?
I sure did. I hired one.
Are they all crazy?
Yeah, this guy was great fun. I mean, he... I have to tell you a quick funny story about him. After he was flying Peterson Aviation, and he'd got checked out in the Hawker at first, we moved him up to the Gulfstream, and he says, Ken, you know, he comes up to me, I got a lot of ladies that are, and he wasn't married at the time. He did happen to get married shortly after that, but he said, I don't know what to tell him. You know, I can't tell him I fly a Hawker because they don't know what that is. I won't even tell him a Gulfstream. And I said, you just say, I fly jets. and his chest got big, and that sounds great to me. So, back, you know, after that. He said he'd been out, you know. He said, yeah, it works, Ken.
Yeah, I bet it does.
Oh, that's very good.
Hey, Ken, I was wondering, did you ever get to participate in any of these military exercises like that, or were people always shooting real bullets at you?
I didn't do big exercises because the war was going on. No, not really, just mostly, and at home, we sat on alert. Even people that were in the military at the time, you know, I always tell my peers, my fellow veterans that, you know, I fought two wars, the Cold War, which was the nuclear war, and then the Vietnam, but the nuclear war, you know, you were basically like a fireman, and you went on base Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, and you didn't get off till the following day, and you slept in a, what they called at the end of the runway. It wasn't a shack. It was a concrete, most of it below ground. And that waiting for the siren to go off and telling you you were taking off on a mission of no return to the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a different kind of a different kind of a war for sure. Wow.
So.
All right. Well, let's move on. Let's see. Normally we would have Rob's Aviation Minute, but instead we have Brian's rebuttal. Brian, do we need to set this up or should I just let it roll?
I usually have two things to say about everything, and with this piece is no different. So number one is I'm not a writer, and Binet certainly knows about that because she got to edit a piece that I wrote a while ago, and I definitely am not a writer, and it takes me a lot of time to write well, and I just haven't had the time to write. The other thing is that I have a speech impediment, and it takes me a really long time to talk, and it's difficult for me to talk, and as a result, editing this piece took forever. So if it sounds like it was pieced together, it really is, because it took me an awful lot of time to piece it together to make it sound as good as it does.
All right.
So with that, you know, I guess the good news is I really, really enjoy doing this stuff, even though it takes so much effort. And this is just my way of keeping up the banter with Rob. So, yeah, let it roll. Rob Mark asked me to record an Aviation Minute and take just 1 minute to record it. Nice try, Rob, but this topic, well, it's just too broad and I'm too passionate to sum up all of your comments and provide my rebuttal in just 1 minute. However, here are my thoughts on your Aviation Minute from last week. Let me start by reviewing a bit of history of frequent flyer programs. The very first frequent flyer program was created in 1972 by Western Direct Marketing for United Airlines. It gave plaques and promotional materials to its members. Their intent was to recognize frequent travelers for their loyalty. The key here being frequent traveler. A very good friend of mine and former boss has a plaque displayed on his office wall that recognizes him as a million-mile flyer, and it's dated 1977. Although he doesn't know how they knew he flew more than a million miles, as there was no official way of tracking these miles at the time. Regardless, he has the plaque proudly displayed on his wall. In 1979, Texas International Airlines created the first frequent flyer program to use mileage tracking to give rewards to passengers. In 1980, Western Airlines created its travel bank, which ultimately became part of Delta Airlines program upon their merger in 1987. The American Airlines Advantage program, launched in 1981, as a modification to the never-realized concept from 1979 that would have given special fares to frequent flying customers. It was quickly followed later that year by programs from United Airlines, Delta Airlines, and in 1982, British Airways entered the mix with their executive club. Typically, airline customers enrolled in these programs to accumulate frequent flyer miles corresponding to the distance flown on that airline or its partners. There are other ways to accumulate miles, and in recent years, more miles were awarded for using co-branded credit and debit cards than for air travel. This is a huge moneymaker for the airlines as they sell those miles to the credit card companies and other organizations that give miles, such as rental car companies, florists, hotels, and so on. And this point addresses Rob's comment that the airlines would love to dump those loyalty programs if they could. This simply isn't true. The airlines make way too much money by selling these miles to their affiliates.
Although it might be true that they would hate to give up possible revenue seats in exchange for these sales, they in no way want to give up this revenue stream. It's simply too profitable for them. In addition, they don't want to dump the programs because they do create loyalty. Well, at least they used to. In my particular case, in 1982, I joined the United Airlines program. I joined the program so I could build up enough miles to attend the eventual funeral of my grandmother. I knew someday she would pass, and I wanted to attend the funeral. And I was too poor at the time to afford to purchase a ticket, and I wanted to have enough miles banked that would allow me to attend. So I flew on United. Flight availability, scheduling, sometimes price afforded me the opportunity to fly on other carriers. So much so that I was able to achieve million mile status on American, but I always seemed to live close enough to an airport that was serviced by United, and they became my carrier of choice. And as a result, I would soon have close to 3 million actual flight miles on United. So their program did build loyalty, even though in the dark years, when it really was a horrible experience to fly on United, the allure of a free ticket, international upgrade, priority boarding, and most recently, economy plus seating kept me flying the friendly skies of United. Rob says that the airlines will continue to tweak the programs, and there is nothing we can do about this. To this, I have two comments. One, yes, they will continue to devalue the programs in their efforts to maximize revenue. Two, I believe as customers, we have the opportunity to change the programs, or at least our attitudes towards them. And I don't believe that we have created this problem, as Rob states. The airlines created the problem and they are trying to fix it in the wrong way. There are two types of flyers, the business and the leisure traveler. Airlines used to care about both of us, and it was in their best interest to attract and retain us. This simply isn't true any longer. The leisure traveler mostly seeks out the least expensive ticket, and the legacy airlines don't care about retaining this passenger type any longer. They simply don't see value in them. What they are after is a highly profitable business traveler. Like I previously said, I believe as customers we have the opportunity to change these programs. Or maybe better said, give up on them altogether. We can change the programs with the way we use our dollar spend. We can choose to spend our money not on our loyalty to the airlines, but spend our hard-earned dollars on where we get the best bang for our buck. Over time, the airlines will realize that the passengers are smart enough to get the best value, and if they want to retain us as customers, they will bring back value. So in the meantime, if the airlines don't care about us leisure travelers, go for the least expensive ticket and realize that you will never get your free ticket. But that's okay. You didn't want to pay for that free ticket in your purchase price anyway. As my mom used to say, there is no free lunch. In my opinion, frequent flyer programs have morphed into revenue recognition programs, and they are focused on business travelers. They no longer reward loyalty, and that's okay. The issue I have with the airlines is that they don't call it for what it is. I really wish that they would call these programs revenue recognition programs or schemes or systems, whatever you want to call it, and align benefits around the passengers with the largest spend. For the rest of us, the era of free tickets is over, and so should our loyalty towards these airlines based on their frequent flyer programs. Frequent flyer benefit programs simply don't exist any longer. And here's where I agree with Rob. We should simply get over it and move on to something more important. And that leaves me wondering what crazy thing Rob will come up with next week to get me going. This is Brian Coleman, Associate Producer for Airplane Geeks, signing off.
That was good. Brian, I had no idea that you had spent that much time in the air.
Yes. And like I said, this quarter I've contributed to the profitability of the airlines yet again. And yeah, I'm real close to 40,000 miles so far, and it's March.
Good job on the recording. Interesting. I think you make some really great points there, some strong arguments. And yeah, we'll have to see if Rob has anything to follow up.
Yeah, I wish he was here.
Yeah. All right. We have a listener recording we want to move on to. This is from Micah. And you've heard Micah's recordings in the past, some of his emails, some of the things that he's sent to us. This is one that we've had kind of for a long time. and we wanted to make sure that we got this out. We have some other recordings from other listeners that we want to play in the future as well. But this one is from Micah, and this is called Lose Flight of Fancy.
As any of you who've done it can attest to, working an overnight shift can be an interesting experience. Doing it consistently for over a decade can truly change one's life. Eating habits become bizarre. Sleep patterns? Well, there is no pattern. And relationships? There's no point in even trying to explain that. Although the organization I worked for had reasonable benefits with paid holidays and vacation time, those benefits were created by day people. There was no regard to the needs of night people, who were always considered strange and shadowy creatures. Generally, night people are always thought of as even more bizarre than airplane geeks, and I was both. Every year, I would need to have a discussion with my supervisor about why I wasn't taking vacation time, and why it had built up to a point where I would lose it at the end of the fiscal year. I always had to explain that for night people, taking one day off at a time was not a viable option. One day off meant having a night off, not a day. It takes multiple days off to create sleep patterns that make any vacation time useful. Based on that need of multiple days to re-regulate my sleep, I would accumulate vacation and holiday time so I could take it in 3-week blocks, one block in the spring and one in the fall. Now, in the fall of 2007, after the usual arguments with my boss about why I was taking 3 weeks off in a row, I decided to spend some time with my mom and dad, Harriet and Lou. After a couple of days to get back into day people mode, I drove down to New Jersey, and the three of us planned a few short trips from there. One of those trips was to visit the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome in Rhinebeck, New York. Although only an hour and a half from my folks' home, my dad and I had only been there once, and that was over 35 years before. We loved that visit, but it was on a weekday when no aircraft were flying. We had wanted to see their original Blériot, Curtis Jenny, and de Havilland Tiger Moth in the air, as well as their perfect reproductions of a Fokker D-7, Fokker DR-1 triplane, Sopwith Camel and Spad 7, flying along with those originals. We did see those, and many other aircraft on the ground, as well as some great original engine displays. But it wasn't what we'd hoped for. My dad and I always talked about going back on a weekend to see those great airplanes fly, but it never materialized. My mom, Harriet, ever indulgent of me and Lou, was more than willing to come along with us. She had not quite come out as an airplane geek yet, but that was soon to change. The drive up the New York State Thruway was beautiful, and the Kingston-Rhinebeck Bridge is particularly scenic as it sits high above the Hudson River. Just northwest of the bridge is the private Kingston-Ulster Airport with its single runway and small fleet of GA aircraft. I've always imagined it would be great to take off there on runway 15. Within seconds from takeoff, you'd find you'd gained 150 feet from all of a sudden being over the Hudson River Valley. Now, to speak frankly, I'd been a bit anxious about this trip, as I knew it would mean some walking. You see, by 2007, my dad's health had deteriorated, and although he could generally get by with his cane, long walks were not easy for him. He was too proud for a wheelchair, and in situations where the surroundings had him feeling especially young and excited, and his 82-year-old body refused to cooperate, he would often become agitated when his pride mixed with humility. We made our way to the aerodrome, which is not far from the bridge, and found it was just like a regular air show. All sorts of parking directors, crowds, excitement. It was not the sleepy little museum Lou and I had toured 35 years before. We walked through the gate, past the hangars, and onto the field. It was a single bucolic grass strip in the middle of a small mountain valley. Although the crowds were there, as was Harriet, for my dad and me, time stopped. Off in the distance, we could hear, "Burt, burt, burt," the sound of an old rotary engine, where speed is controlled by the ignition, not a throttle. It was music to us. We felt like we were in a real-life Dawn Patrol, one of our favorite films. We expected Errol Flynn, David Niven, and Basil Rathbone to come walking out of one of the buildings at any time. Lou, Harriet, and I walked down the line toward the bleachers to settle in and await the show. We found some great seats, opened our cooler, and had some soft drinks and sandwiches as we watched a new standard D-25 biplane come and go from the field. It was offering barnstorming rides, just as it did back in the 1930s. The flights were over the Hudson River and back for a 15 to 20 minute sightseeing tour. It just seemed magical. I had always wanted to fly in an open cockpit and mentioned it as we were watching. Harriet and Lou encouraged me to do it, and I told them that I would if they would come along too, as a new standard D25 holds up to 4 passengers. There was no way to convince them to come along, and I finally gave in to their encouragement and went to the booth to reserve a flight on my own. My name was called, and I was issued a cotton helmet and goggles. I have to say, I felt just as foolish as I looked wearing them. Here I was, a 50-something-year-old man in a Hawaiian shirt with 1930s flight gear on my head. Airplane geek on the inside, dork on the outside. Such is my lot in life. In any event, it was my turn to climb into the new standard D-25 and take my flight. How can I describe it? Engine roar, wind in my face, the ground slipping away, then a turn to the west toward the Hudson. It was beautiful. It was incredible. I was flying on a perfect day in an open cockpit biplane. We crossed the Hudson just north of the Kingston-Rhinebeck Bridge and turned back east, just short of the Kingston-Ulster Airport. Just after the turn, the pilot did a very brief pushover so we could get a sense of negative G. Wow! We turned to get back in the pattern and made our approach from the south, landing in the same grass field we took off from. The flight was over far too soon, and Harriet met me at the gate. I know I had an ear-to-ear grin on my face because a smile was returned from her the minute she saw me. I told her how marvelous it was as we walked back to Lou, who was waiting in the stands. The grin was still on my face when I told my dad that he had to go fly. I knew he'd never flown in an open cockpit before. How often does an opportunity like this present itself? By now, he was grinning too. That convinced Harriet. She said she wanted to go fly, and that's finally what convinced Lou. Harriet went off to the booth to get tickets, and I sat with my dad until she came back. I was so looking forward to having my dad fly in a biplane. I was sorry he didn't come along with me, but I still wanted to be able to share the experience with him. I couldn't wait to see his smile when he got off the plane. Lou was excited, too. In fact, he was thrilled. He was an 82-year-old airplane geek, going for his first flight in an open cockpit. At the same time, though, I was concerned. Now, physically, Lou wasn't the same dad I grew up with. I wasn't sure how he would climb onto the lower wing of the D-25 and maneuver his way into the seat. There was only so much help Harriet and I could give him. As usual, my dad and I were in tune with one another. He knew he might not be able to make it into the plane. With his dignity and pride intact, he backed out by saying this, "You know, Micah, I think your mother might feel safer with you by her side rather than me. Why don't I wait here and you go fly with your mother?" I knew what he was saying, and we both knew he was looking for a way to back out without embarrassing himself. I nodded, smiled, and went along for my second ride in a new standard D-25, this time with Harriet sitting next to me. It was a great flight, and I think this flight was the one that really allowed for Harriet to come out as a true airplane geek that she always was. In some ways, though, it was a very sad flight, too. My airplane geek dad never got to fly in an open cockpit. In fact, he never got to fly again. He slipped on some ice just 2 months after this trip, and finally passed 4 months later, in April of 2008. But you know, Lou was an airplane geek to the very end. During his last few days in the hospital, at times he would have a repeated dream and would talk out loud. What was that dream? Well, he was describing an acrobatic performance at an air show, obviously enjoying what he could only see, as he was grinning, just like he was at the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome. For the airplane geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
Oh, wow. What a great story.
You just took the words right out of my mouth.
Micah always brings it.
He does. He does. And one thing we have is a photo of Micah in that helmet and goggles. So if you never go look at the show notes, this is the episode to do that. Airplanegeeks.com/339. Scroll down and we'll have the photo of Micah in his goggles.
It's super.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. All right, we have to move on. Let's see some listener mail just really quickly because we're kind of running out of time here. We heard from Tom. He sent us a link to an article from in CNN, Ghost Rider, the B-52 resurrected from Desert Boneyard. Tom says, "I came across this article. Very cool to see an airframe brought back from the boneyard storage." He says, "I would ask David if he's aware of any other aircraft that may have been brought back to service from Davis-Monthan storage." Well, David responds, and he says basically, yes, he says, off the top of my head, and these are aircraft brought back from the boneyard, he says, the P3, the C-130, the F-4, the F-5, the F-15, the F-16, the E-2C, F-18s, C-135s, the A-4, and the A-7. So all that's off the top of David's head. He also sent us the link to the Aerospace Maintenance and Regeneration Group, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I understand David is also working on a piece that describes the task of bringing back aircraft from, you know, what we like to call the boneyard. He says that, you know, many people assume that airplanes go out to the desert to live there forever, I guess. And that's not the case, that there's a reason why the word regeneration is part of the title.
Yeah, Ken, I wonder how many of your aircraft are out there.
Well, I got a chance to go there back probably, gosh, it's been a long time now, but we were actually looking for my airplane. A fellow that I worked for me at Peterson was a retired full colonel, Air Force full colonel, and he had taken up writing, and he was writing articles for the Air and Space Magazine, which is published by the
Smithsonian.
The Smithsonian, correct. And he got an assignment to do an article on the breakup of the B-52s. And so I go with him and got a complete tour of the boneyard when they were picking them up for the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, the SALT Treaty. And that's where we would overfly Russia and view the breakup of their missiles, and they overfly us with a satellite and view the breakup of the B-52s at Davis-Monthan. It was quite something to go down there and see that.
Now, didn't they break up the B-52s with big blocks of concrete, basically, and sort of chop off the wings? Wasn't that what they did?
No, it was actually, for lack of a better term, it really like a guillotine, you know?
Ah, yes, okay.
It was a big crane with a huge metal sharpened, not real sharp, but sharpened plate of metal. And they would, the rule that was put into the treaty was that they had to break the wings off at the root, and they had to break the cockpit off, and they had to break the tail off. So they'd do four breaks, and it was really sad to watch them do it.
Yeah, sure. And like you say, they did them out in the open so that the Soviet satellites could actually see this taking place. Yeah, yeah.
It's correct. It was a thrill to be there, and we never – my airplane – We found 666, the tail number 666, and mine was 665. And like I said earlier, you can see 665 in the museum now. But we were puzzled about why we couldn't find it. And he tracked it down. He went to the aircraft records section in, I think, in Florida then. And that's where they told him, if it's not in the file. And he said it was there. It was an empty folder. And they said, well, it's at the Air Force Museum. And that's how I found out about it being in the Air Force Museum.
Huh, so. Interesting.
Crazy, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone should go to an aircraft boneyard at some time in their life. I've been to Davis-Monthan. I was there for one of my little AvGeek festivals, and we were there for the air show. But they also took us for a little spin. It is just an amazing thing to see.
It is.
Yeah, they are. Which is the one that's across the road from the Pima Air
that's
and
it.
Space?
That's
the
that's
one.
It. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the one.
So they have a
Davis-Monthan. Yeah.
All right. Well, they at the Pima Air Museum there, they have a B-52 there.
Yes, they do.
And I was told that originally was actually across the road in the boneyard.
I'm sure it was. Yeah.
And that one night under cover of darkness, they took down the fence around the boneyard.
Yeah, I think that's a true story.
I think it is too. And they wheeled this B-52 across the road, put it in the museum, put the fences back up, and said, "Hey, it's a museum piece."
Yeah, yeah,
wonderful. Now,
the obvious question, if you want a tip of information, obvious question I had when I was there is, okay, so you break them up, and then what happens? Well, the answer is there's two companies. At that time, close by there in Tucson, and one of them takes and recycles all the metal and the rubber, and the other one takes all the pieces and puts it, loads it on into big containers and ships it over to Japan or something like that. So it was an interesting
I'm not surprised.
Answer to the question.
Yeah, not surprised. Yeah, that's a great area. The Pima Air and Space Museum is just fantastic, amazing. I forget. I think they have over 1,000 airplanes there, aircraft there. Neat. That's great. There's also, if you're interested in sort of Cold War stuff, there's a Nike missile site that's not too far from there. And you can go down and tour that. You can sit in the chairs. You can push the button, you know.
That's great.
But similar to chopping off the wings and the nose and tail, as far as Nike missile sites on this one, what they did is they, and maybe this is where my concrete thing comes from, but they put a big block of concrete over the opening of the silo, which is stationary. You can tell from a satellite photo that this thing isn't going to go anywhere, and even though it's got a Nike missile inside the silo that you can actually look at. And you can see the nose of from the satellite image. You can also tell that with this block of concrete, this was the assurance for the Soviets that this was not an active site, that in fact this missile could not be launched. So.
Interesting.
Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff around that area.
Very much so.
Okay, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We've got a lot of other really interesting listener email comments and things that we want to talk to, and we'll try to get to some of them coming up. We had a great email from Rocky about the pilot shortage, and we want to make sure we get to that. We'll try to do that next time. So we want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 339 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Find us at airplanegeeks.com, or if you'd like to go straight to the show notes, and you must because you need to see the picture of Mike, if nothing else, you can get to that quickly by going to airplanegeeks.com/339. Of course, we're also on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, you can listen to us on Stitcher.com, also on TuneIn Radio. Our email is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can actually leave us a recorded message, a little voicemail. Binet, do you remember the number?
Why, yes, I do. If you guys want to call the Airplane Geeks, dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Perfect. Thank you, Binet.
Thank you.
Binet, tell our listeners where they can find you online.
Well, as always, you can find me at aviationqueen.com. You can also find me at airwaysnews.com, airtravel.about.com, and you can find me on Twitter at avqueenbinet.
Fantastic. Thank you,
Binet. And I'm on Google+, too.
Yay! Yeah, we want to thank our guest, Ken Curry, president of KC Aviation Consultants. Ken, we'll give you another opportunity to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Oh, very good. Thank you. I certainly enjoyed it. And they can reach me by telephone at 818-632-9808 or my personal email, kjcurry@earthlink.net.
And Curry is C-U-R-R-Y.
C-U-R-R-Y. Yes, sir. Right. Correct.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Max. It was a pleasure.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye. My phone is 818-698-0808.
Oh, we lost part of the phone number.
Yeah. It's dropping like crazy.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of really? just say the phone number again.
Okay.
And we'll see if we can get it through without any dropouts.
All right. It's 818-632-98.
Oh, we got 98 and then it stopped. Just do the last four. Yeah, just do the last. I can edit this. It okay. won't be easy, but just say
See,
the last.
It's not just me.
I know. It's not just you, Binet.
9-8.
Oh, we only got 9-8 again.
This is crazy.
Maybe I should say it slower. Okay, 818-632-9888. Dropped off again.
Yep. Just say the last two. See if that'll work.
08.